at the stove when Emmanuel escorts us in, throwing a flour-dusted drumstick into the pan of sizzling oil. The spattering drumstick is quickly followed by four more. The moment we appear, however, she pulls herself away from the stove and produces a pot of coffee. She doesn't ask, but pours out two mugs, handing one to each of us. Having just consumed my body weight in caffeine, I'm tempted to wave off, but the look on her face stops me. Stoic, but welcoming. She is going through her steps, just as earlier today, I did mine. As if reading my mind, Lotha murmurs beside me. Take it. It's a Haitian thing. Drink up. I take the mug, thanking her profusely. Given she hadn't offered me coffee the first time I appeared, I appreciate that I've now risen in her esteem, while already wondering how long that will last. The living area is too small for four, especially when one of them is supersized. Lotham takes the hint. He downs his mug, then disappears back to the second floor landing, where I can soon hear him yapping away on the phone. Emmanuel remains with me, his hands fidgeting in front of him.
What would you like to see?
He asks at last. Gerline moves away from me in the tiny space to throw more chicken into the skillet, more hissing and crackling. Walk me through the living arrangements. Emmanuel shows me the doorway leading to the single bedroom, which belongs to his aunt. Across from it is a cramped bathroom with a single vanity, toilet, and tub-shower combo. There is a mirrored medicine cabinet above the sink, a cheap shelving unit over the toilet. Shared space is cluttered space, which leaves me with much to sort out. For now, I follow Emmanuel back to the family room. He gestures to the couch. For Lily, he explains, then to the floor. For me. A nightstand next to the sofa. For my sister. Followed by a dresser wedged next to the TV stand, then the lowest shelf of the entertainment unit, which is lined with books. Also for my sister. That leaves two pieces of furniture, which must be Emmanuel's. It's not a large search area, but it's a lot to process, given the riot of personal possessions, family photos, and miscellaneous knickknacks. It's like peering into a dense forest, then slowly trying to pick out a single leaf. I take a seat on the sofa, then stand up again. Where did your sister sit? I ask Emmanuel. Everyone has their spot. He gestures to the end, closest to the wall, where an oversized ceramic lamp tops the nightstand, excellent lighting for a serious reader. How did she sit? I ask Emmanuel next. Straight up? Sideways? Curled up? Can you show me? Emmanuel moves to the couch. He appears to consider the matter, then settles himself into the cushions, striking a pose. Sideways? Curled up? Again closer to the lighting. Emmanuel bounces up. I nod in his direction as I take over Angelique's position on the sofa. Then, for a long while, I don't do anything at all. I just sit there and try to see what Angelique would see. Not rows of clutter, but pieces of memory. A 15-year-old girl, her family split between this country and the island she used to call home. Emmanuel drifts into the kitchen, taking a seat at the kitchen table, where his heavily stickered laptop is up and running. Doing homework, or updating his sister's digital memorial, or monitoring her virtual high school? I wonder what his friends think, if he has anyone he can talk to. I refocus my eyes on the wall ahead of me. Eventually, I get up. I open each dresser drawer and work my way through. It feels intrusive, pawing through someone's piles of clothes. Having the family in the same room doesn't help. I keep my movements brisk and my attention focused. It's hard enough to do this once. I don't want to have to repeat. I don't stumble upon any hidden notes, photos, diaries. I feel out each drawer for false bottoms, then peek behind the dresser itself. There are routine places, contraband 101, items tucked under floorboards, taped beneath shelves, under this object, behind this piece of furniture. I take down the framed photo of Angelique's mom and, with my back to the kitchen, delicately dismantle it. My efforts are rewarded by the discovery of a scrap of thick white paper. It's covered by a child's crayon drawing of a heart and flowers. Written across the top in large looping script are the words, "Moi, vraiment, ou." I don't have to know Creole to guess it reads, "I love you." I return the note to its place behind the photo, feeling even more intrusive. I wander the bookshelves, the makeshift altar, the riot of greenhouse plants. I worked on a missing persons case once where a thumb drive of illicit photos was slipped inside the pot of a fake ficus tree. These plants involve moist, loamy soil, however, and none appear recently disturbed. I move to the bathroom, where I check the medicine cabinet and beauty products littering the shelves above the toilet. I shake aerosol cans for fake bottoms, open up makeup containers just in case. There is nothing in the handle of the hairbrush, taped inside the toilet tank, or bolted to the underside of the sink. I account for the wooden baseboards, then check the door frame before emptying out the contents beneath the sink. Lots of cleaners, toilet paper, and feminine hygiene products. Given that a classic travel hack is to hide cash inside sanitary pads or tampon wrappers, I pull out every item in the boxes. When I look up, Detective Lotham has returned and is shaking his head at me. I shrug, get back to it. Other classic hiding spots: inside the freezer, inside the door of the freezer, tucked between wall cabinets or behind crown molding. I once found a stash of dope inside a vacuum cleaner. Turned out to belong to the mother's boyfriend and had nothing to do with her son's disappearance, but he was pissed at me for months. And yes, my relationship with the entire family went downhill from there. I eventually discovered the body of the 9-year-old locked in the trunk of an abandoned car on his grandfather's property. The murder trial is due to start sometime next year. I return to the living area, confront the couch. I take it apart cushion by cushion. Fortunately, it doesn't include a sofa bed, so I don't have to rearrange the entire room. Then I return to my perch at the end of the sofa and resume thinking like a 15-year-old girl. This is where I watch TV, surf my phone, hang with my family. This is where I stay up late, tuck into bed, confront each morning. In this entire apartment, this corner of the couch, this nightstand, that bureau, are mine alone. Slivers of privacy in an arrangement where my younger brother is also living, sleeping, waking right beside me. And maybe I don't mind. I protected my baby brother from our father. I led him from our collapsing house. Even now, I have promised us both a better future. But maybe I met someone? Or someone found me? Maybe, for a moment, I wanted my own dream, my own secret, my own life. But how? In a place this small, in an apartment this crowded, where even my computer is shared? I leave the photos and inspect the row of books. I take down each one, reading the title, fluffing the pages. A few are in French, but most are English. None of them are books that I understand. Apparently, Angelique liked to read everything from bios on Madame Curie to Elizabeth Blackwell. I flip through an anatomy book where I discover inserted sheets from Angelique's sketchpad, incredibly realistic renderings of skeletal systems and muscle groups. She was clearly a gifted artist, at least to my untrained eye. I give up on that mission and return to the couch. It's already been more than an hour. The chicken is done and currently warming in the oven. If I wasn't intruding before, I am now. Gerline has joined her nephew at the table, both of them clearly anxious. I should leave them so they can finally collapse in peace. One last try. I'm 15. I've met a female friend, boyfriend, exciting stranger. I don't know what Angelique was into. That's the whole problem. But I know one thing she had, a second phone, which she would have had to hide from her aunt and brother, but would want to check frequently. I twist around. There's nothing tucked in the sofa cushions, nor taped beneath the coffee table, nor under the sofa. I lean closer to the nightstand, snapping on the brightly colored lamp. And then, just like that, I know. Her spot on the sofa, the way she sat, not leaning forward or slouching down, but angling toward the wall. Better light to read by, I'd thought. But maybe it was just plain better light. Now I reach up and snap off the bulb. Then I pick up the entire lamp with its large ceramic base covered in checks of red, purples, and turquoise. When I shake it, there's no rattling sound or sense of movement, but the weight of it, so solid, so heavy. I feel beneath it until my fingers close around the large bolt that holds the whole thing together. I don't need a tool. The bolt is already loose, waiting. I twist the nut. I slowly pull off the base. And just like that, banded rolls of bills go thumping out onto the floor. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Not hundreds of dollars, but thousands in tightly bundled cash. A screech at the kitchen table as Emmanuel shoves back his chair. A terrible gasp from Gerline, hand flying to her mouth. Detective Lotham appears in the doorway. I shake out three more rolls. We all watch them roll across the rug. Thousands and thousands of dollars in cold, hard cash. Way more money than any teenager could have accrued by legal means. Gerline places her head in her hands and starts to cry. Chapter 14. The happy hour crowd is firmly entrenched by the time I return to Stoney's Pub. I grab an apron, wash my hands, and get straight to work banging out beer and running plates of food. My mind keeps returning to the rolls of cash hidden in Angelique's lamp. When I left, Detective Lotham was bagging the evidence. The fact that Gerline and Emmanuel weren't protesting his removal of large sums of money from their humble apartment confirmed that the money wasn't theirs, and the implications troubling. Not being an official investigator type, I can only guess what kind of forensic tests will be conducted on the cash. Fingerprinting, for sure. My understanding is that new bills can often yield useful prints. Anything in circulation too long, however, has been touched by too many greasy hands, leaving behind a mess of smudged partials. They'd test each bill for chemical residue, traces of drugs, maybe some cool random mold that could only be found in one basement in all of Boston. Or not. I'd read about a case where the serial numbers on the bills were traced to a particular ATM, which allowed the police to pull video and identify the person who withdrew the funds. That would be great. Given how tightly bound the money was, however, I don't have an impression of crispness, consecutive serial numbers, or, really, any useful information. It looked like rolls of hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars per bundle, making the total stash worth tens of thousands. What in the world could a teenage girl be doing to earn that kind of money? Prostitution is the first thought that comes to mind, and would fit with an overall storyline of human trafficking. But I certainly hadn't seen any sign of sexy clothes or paraphernalia, let alone when. Angelique shared her sleeping quarters with her brother. If she was sneaking out, surely he'd be sharing those details by now. Not to mention tens of thousands is a lot of money for that scenario. No pimp wants the hired help to achieve financial independence.
Lady, you gonna keep pouring that beer?
A voice jolts me from my reverie. Sure enough, I've topped off the glass and am now gushing foam down the sides. I flush, knock off the tap, deliver the beverage. When I return, Stoney looks like he's wondering if no help might be better than mine. Fair enough. Illegal income, I tell him. What are the local options? He appears to take my inquiry seriously as he stacks dirty glasses on a tray for delivery to the kitchen.
Drugs.
No sign of product. Plus, narc dogs would have sniffed out the cash if it had been in contact with meth, dope, whatever. I line up 4 half glasses, toss in ice, start doling out rum. Stoney doesn't question this statement.
Sex.
Possible, but not probable.
Stolen goods.
Hadn't thought of that. I top the rum with Coke, then swing back around the bar to deliver the drinks to the waiting table. When I return, Stoney has finished with the dirty glasses and is now ringing up an order for a waiting patron. What kind of stolen goods? I ask him.
Electronics, cell phones, guns.
Not sure our girl has that skill set or resources. She's the studious type, wants to be a doctor when she grows up. Viv appears from the kitchen, one of her rare appearances, and hands me 3 plates. I shoot them to the end of the bar, picking up an order for a pitcher of beer on my way back.
Sell off a kidney?
Stoney asks next. Think the family would have noticed. I go to work filling the pitcher. I could ask about any recent surgeries. Maybe Angelique had suffered appendicitis that wasn't really appendicitis, or had tonsils that weren't really her tonsils removed. Seems far-fetched, however, that she could pull off such a ruse in such tight quarters.
Credit card fraud,
Stoney supplies next,
or identity theft.
Worthy of consideration. We know Angelique had a fake ID. Why not a credit card in someone else's name? She could charge items online, have them delivered to her home, then return them to local stores for cash or credit. Seems like the kind of activity, however, that would have drawn attention and been shared with the cops by now. Unless she used someone else's house for delivery? A co-conspirator? The other half of us? Interesting. Of all the options, white-collar crime sounds like the best fit with the picture of the Angelique I'm building in my mind. Then again, my image is based on information from her family and friends, and clearly, they don't know everything about her. Angelique went to high school by day and took online courses by night. A lot of school, actual and virtual, for a teenager. Could that be a hint? Illegal activity disguised as schoolwork? Maybe she sold exam answers and/or term papers. But tens of thousands of dollars worth? Are there even enough kids in high school or at GEDnow.com to supply that kind of income? I keep turning it over in my mind, but still can't come up with a venture, illegal or otherwise, that can account for Angelique's level of cash. What if she found the money? Or stole it? Maybe she wasn't a dope dealer, but say she babysat for a drug kingpin, discovered a stash of cash, and thought she could get away with helping herself. Until the dealer found out and... Now, I have too many possibilities to consider, though most of them result in Angelique being shot as a message to others versus being kidnapped for 11 months. Drug dealers are not the subtle sort. I dole out shots, top off drinks. I operate on muscle memory, a woman who spent the majority of her adult life in bars, while my mind whirs and chugs and ponders. None of it brings me peace. Help us, Angelique had encoded into her school essay. A girl clearly in trouble and desperate enough to take a shot at reaching out. I agreed with what Detective Lotham had said. Just because someone hadn't walked into the cybercafe with a gun pointed at Angelique's head didn't mean she wasn't under duress. Then another possibility came to me, scarier and sadder than all the others. She could have been kidnapped to serve as recruitment bait. a quiet, pretty immigrant teen, held against her will, then sent out to bus stops and train stations to meet other unsuspecting teens and lure them over to meet her friends. Sex traffickers, pimps, dope dealers. How much would that erode a natural caretaker such as Angelique, a girl who'd rescued her own mother and brother? If the threat against her family, either here or in Haiti, was significant enough, she wouldn't have a choice but to obey. This scenario wouldn't account for why Angelique had rolls of bills stashed in a lamp, but it would explain her disappearance, as well as her sudden reappearance seeking help. As for how she might have gotten involved in sex trafficking, all I can think of is the rec center. According to her friends, she'd become distant after attending the summer program there. Because she'd met someone? Seen something? I have no idea, but it seems as good a starting place as any. First thing tomorrow, I'll find my new friend Charlie and head on over. Like Angelique, I do best with a plan. Which makes me wonder where Angelique is right now. Terrified or determined? Longing for her brother or resigned to her fate? And the mysterious us? Another girl? Several girls? Dozens of girls? All waiting for someone to rescue them from the dark? The implications of that. The responsibility for all those lives. When I've never even rescued one living soul. I can't think about it. Angelique, others, out there alone. Please, 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 for their sakes, let me get this right. By the time the night owls have been shown to the door, my mood is subdued. I scrub and polish, stack and sweep in silence. Viv is in the kitchen, scouring down, while Stoney closes out the register. It's been a long day. I should head to a meeting, then get some sleep. Or maybe I could go for a run. It's late and dark and dangerous, but that's never stopped me before. Sometimes my blood flows too close to my skin. I can feel my own nerve endings spark and snap, the pressure building in my chest. Once upon a time, I would head to a bar, slamming back shots of tequila and dancing with abandon. Dance, drink, dance. Or maybe it had been drink, dance, drink. Oblivion. That's what I sought, what I still seek. One precious moment when I'm no longer trapped inside my own head, knowing things I don't want to know, remembering things I don't want to remember. Worrying about things I can't change. As I do too often, I think of Paul. The feel of his lips whispering down my neck, the tickle of his hair, the strength of his hands, the beginning when he made me feel safe, the end when I broke his heart and shattered the last of my self-respect. I don't want to go to a meeting. I don't want to run. I want to grab a bottle of Hornitos, crawl upstairs, and dial his phone number. The pain will be swift and brutal, like a razor to the soul. Then I can lie there and feel myself bleed while guzzling tequila. Drink and wallow. Maybe Piper the homicidal cat likes pity parties too. You never know. Viv comes charging out, already thrusting her arms into her coat. Her husband is waiting just outside the door to walk her home. It's sweet and charming and salt on my gaping wound. Addicts are particularly good at this game. Everyone's life is easier, better, happier. If we could be those people, then we wouldn't need to drink again. It's everyone else's fault. The universe's, never our own. Go to a meeting. Just walk out the front door and go. I eye the rows of bottles that line the back wall. I feel the beast stir to life in my belly, opening its eyes, stretching out its claws. It's been a hard day, and I'm tired and alone and white. Dear God, when did I become this impossibly glow-in-the-dark neon white so that everyone stares at me and no one knows me? My skin color has made me the enemy. a walking advertisement for entitlement and privilege, except I don't feel like any of those things. I feel like I've always felt broken, as if the whole rest of the world knows something I don't, feels things I can't, connects in ways I've never learned how. Of course, I've spent enough time by now in marginalized communities to understand there's more to that story. That for all my internal angst, the truth is, I grew up with limited fears and unlimited dreams. I had implicit faith in authority and never thought to question the system. I had an innate understanding of the world and my place in it, let alone a roof over my head, food in the fridge, and a safe neighborhood to grow up in. Which is privilege indeed. I should go to a meeting, just walk out the front door, find my people, and set down my burden. Breathe. The restless dragon, fully awake now, uncoils. It whispers memories of my very first drink, a sip of my father's Jack and Coke fetched by my 8-year-old self for my already slurring parent. The feel of caffeine and bourbon sliding down my throat, both hot and cold, melting and jolting. The slow-spreading euphoria that brought a flush to my impossibly young face. Not a bottle, just a shot, or two or three. Then I'll sleep. Sleep is good. I'll feel better after a good night's rest. Sit. Stony stands in front of me. He grabs the chair I just stacked on the table, flips it back down, points at the hard wooden seat. Sit. I do. A second chair, slapped down next to the first, then a pause, as he disappears and I close my eyes, count to 100 by fives, then when that doesn't work, by sevens. I'd just hit 84 when Stoney reappears with 2 mugs of coffee. Decaf. He keeps one, hands over the other. He takes up position across from me. We both sip our coffee in silence. You married? I ask him at last. The pressure is easing in my chest, but I grip my coffee mug hard, like an anchor. Another trick. Rattle off 5 things you can see right now in as much visual detail as possible. I spy with my little eye as a grounding exercise. If that doesn't work, then 5 things for 5 senses. The smell of freshly brewed coffee. The sound of the buzzing overhead lights. The feel of the warm mug. The look on Stoney's impassive face. The taste of regret. Stoney takes his time answering.
Was. She died. Ovarian cancer.
I'm sorry.
Had 30 amazing years. Appreciated every minute. Makes me luckier than most.
Kids?
3. 2 girls and a boy. One of my girls lives in Florida now. Keeps asking me to join her and her family. But this is my home.
You grew up here?
New Jersey. But moved here when I was in my teens. Close enough.
This neighborhood. This bar. These are your memories.
I see my Camille everywhere.
Stoney affirms.
And I'm not complaining.
Grandkids?
4. Ages 3 to 8, 2 in Florida, 2 in New York.
All 3 of your kids are married?
My 2 girls. Jerome, my son, died at 16. Not easy to be a young black man. Harder still when you're 16, stupid and susceptible to your peers.
As usual with Stoney, it's what he doesn't say that matters most. Gangs or drugs, I ask at last.
Drugs. Broke his mother's heart.
His father's, too, but that went without saying. Gonna die in this bar? I ask him.
That's the plan.
What's it like, I whisper, to know exactly what you want, to know this is your home, to feel like you belong? Stoney doesn't answer, but then I don't expect him to.
You know the family?
His turn to question.
The missing girl, Badeau?
No. This is what I do. I look up cold cases involving missing persons.
Then I find them. How many?
14.
How long?
9 years, more or less.
How'd you get started?
Fluke thing. I had just joined AA. One of the women was struggling with the disappearance of her daughter. The police thought she'd run away. Margaret didn't believe, but couldn't argue. I asked a few questions, which led to a few more, then a few more. Addicts are prone to obsession. I ended up tracking the daughter to a flop house where she was holed up with her abusive boyfriend. The girl was underage, so I called the cops. They closed in for the arrest, but not before the boyfriend shot her, then himself. Classic murder-suicide.
Not a happy story.
No, but maybe that's why I keep coming back for more. I don't trust happy. These cases, these situations, I understand. Stony nods, sips more coffee. Thank you, I say at last. No comment. You know your cat is crazy, right? And or a serial killer? No comment. But she does have a nice purr, I allow. Stony smiles. We both drain our mugs. Then, together, we restack the chairs, wash out our cups, rinse the coffee pot. Stony goes home, and, no bottle in hand, I head upstairs. In my dreams, Angelique appears. She is running down a long, dark alley that gets longer and darker with every step. She is a blur of frantically pounding limbs, dark hair bouncing beneath a bright red ball cap. Help me, she screams, disappearing around a corner. Except when I get there, she's already flying around the next sharp turn. So I run left, then right, zigging and zagging and zigging, but never gaining any ground. I can just hear the echo of her footsteps, the sound of her breathing as she races ahead. Help me, help me, help me! Abruptly, the dark alley is gone. And I'm standing at the grassy edge of a road, peering at the crumpled remains of my parents' car, their bloody faces slammed wide-eyed into the crackled windshield. No, I'm underwater, fighting to get away from Lainey Whitehorse's skeletal grasp as she pulls me down, down, down. I try to pinch my skin. I try to scream at myself to wake up, but it doesn't work. I remain trapped in a nightmarish slideshow where the scenes go from bad to awful to terrifying to Paul, his head on my lap, his body bathed in blood.
What did you do, Frankie?
He screams at me, his fingers reaching out like talons.
Dear God, what did you do?
Shh, I want to tell him. Save your strength. But it's too late. A kid is screaming. A gun is booming. No place to go. Nothing we can do. I reach for his hand.
What did you do?
He asks me one last time as the life drains out of him. So much blood. Too much. And yet still he grips my hand. Still he looks to me.
I loved you.
Then I close my eyes as light explodes around us, brilliant, excruciating, searing. I scream, in my dream, in my sleep. I pray the pain will be quick. Now, as then, it isn't. Chapter 15. Morning disorients me. I wake up with a feeling of dread and a pit in my stomach. For a moment, I lie still. I drank. That must be it. I caved. I gave in to the beast, and now I have to start my sobriety all over again. Tears are already leaking out of the corners of my eyes before my mental fog lifts, and I remember I didn't break. Stony pulling down the chair. Stony talking to me. And then, I do cry, from sheer relief, because my sobriety is the one and only accomplishment in my whole fucking miserable life, and to lose that? I will go to a meeting today. Before work, I promise myself. There must be a noontime gathering somewhere. There always is. I sit up and swing my legs over the bed. Then I realize what's different. No claws slash my bare skin. No rodent carcasses decorate the floor. For that matter, I have no memory of a comforting rumble easing my chronic nightmares. I peer beneath the mattress. No glowing green eyes. I check the water bowl. It appears untouched. Apparently, my roommate never returned home last night. Given we've only been together a matter of days, that shouldn't bother me, but it does. I brush my teeth, shower, pick out the day's wardrobe, all with half an ear listening for sounds from the cat door. By the time I'm ready to go, there's still no sign of Piper. I feel like I should leave some food out for her, but I haven't gone grocery shopping, and there's not a scrap of sustenance in my kitchen. I head down to the kitchen, where I rummage till I find the brick of cheese. I peel off a slice. I don't think Stony or Viv will mind. I shred the cheese into smaller bits, then return to my apartment, where I place the cat snack next to her water bowl. I'm not sure what else I can do. So even though I still feel unsettled, I get on with the day's business. I don't know much about the rec center. It's on my printed map, a large structure to the north in a sea of green. Once again, the presence of such a large park in the middle of inner city urban density surprises me. But yeah, if I were a bored teen, I'd probably go there. It's a far walk, which means I should take a bus, which means I have to once again figure out Boston's mass transit system. I feel overwhelmed already. What elderly lady is going to save me today? I head for Dunkin' Donuts first. I need the coffee as well as the advice. Given the late morning hour, I'm the only customer, the shocking white woman passing through the glass doors. I recognize the crew of older black women behind the counter from before, including the manager who'd helped me with directions to Le Foyer. Most of them appear to remember me too. It makes it easy to order a large coffee, then plunk down my map and request assistance. This time, they all gather round, and I get bus routes and pickup times. "Where you living now, girl?" the manager, Charity, asks me. She is tall and round and somehow impressive despite the brown and fuchsia uniform. "I'm working at Stoney's, live above the bar." "You a bartender?" Arched brow. A silver star winks at the end. Stud or sticker, I can't decide. "I make an excellent mojito," I inform her. "You should come by sometime. I owe you for the help with directions." Charity nods at me. The other women appear pleased. "Why the rec center, hon? You got kids?" "No, but I've heard good things and want to learn more." "I'm an alcoholic," I volunteer, having learned that in many situations, it helps break the ice. I was wondering if there was something I could do to help, you know, having been there, done that myself. Nodding heads, Charity flips over my map and jots down some notes. She has a large, looping script that is much prettier than mine. She murmurs some questions in what I assume is French to her companions. Various French replies produce more scrawled notes. In the end, Charity divides my paper into three sections. The first contains numbers, the second contains names, and below the midway line dividing the page are a whole mess of names and numbers. She walks me through it. The bus schedule, which I'd recognized, the names of her boys at the center who can help me out, and a list of the best restaurants. "Skinny girl like you needs to eat," Charity provides as explanation. In a culture that prides itself on curves, I must look particularly pathetic. Honestly, I've been begging God for breasts since the day I turned 13. Anytime now. I thank her sincerely. High fives to all. There's a chime as a car pulls up to the drive-thru. They return to their stations, and I head once more for the door, armed with coffee and my new and improved local guide. I get on and off the right bus. It makes me smile so brightly, even the bus driver, a stoic black man who appears to be somewhere between old and ancient, grins back. I smile larger, and he shakes his head.
You take care of yourself, you hear?
He says. And the fact I got him to speak feels like my second triumph of the day. Forget Detective Lotham. Maybe I'm growing on the entire population of Mattapan. My heady sense of success lasts until I make it to the front of the vast rec center complex. Again, much larger than I expected, and given the surrounding park, tennis courts, and running paths, nothing like I imagined. Sure, the rec center looks slightly tired and stooped, a giant metal hangar that had probably been very impressive in its heyday and appears in need of a good power washing and paint job. But the size, the access to the outdoors, I've visited plenty of neighborhoods with less. Of course, I can't figure out how to get in. If what my new AA bud Charlie said was true, the center's hours would be mostly after school, evenings and weekends, which probably explains the locked front doors. However, a taped sign advises deliveries around back. I'm a delivery, sort of. I wander around the massive building. This close, I can see the pitting in the metal side panels, more signs of age. I'd guess the faded blue structure was built in the 70s or 80s, maybe some government initiative to provide more opportunities for inner-city youths. I wouldn't mind having these paths to run on, or basketball courts, or soccer fields. They're all empty now, but I'd guess around 3 in the afternoon, this place really comes alive. I discover a side door, give it a tug. No luck. Keep on walking. All the way behind the building now. A second set of double doors, twin to the first. This time, when I pull, the tinted glass door gives way. I step inside the cool, shadowed depths, seeking signs of human life. There's a check-in counter directly across from me. When I get closer, I see bins with various kinds of sporting equipment stacked behind it, locked behind metal grates. So this is where the kids check out the goods before heading out into the vast green park. I follow the shadowed corridor deeper into the building. Given the lack of overhead lights and the deep hush broken only by the sound of my tennis shoes on concrete, the whole place is slightly ominous. Outside is filled with promise, but as for the inside, I spent a few days in county lockup once, and this makes me think of that. I wonder if the kids feel the same. I walk past double doors leading to an indoor gym, but both are locked. Next up, I spy what appears to be a weight room, followed by some kind of kitchen area. Again, all shuttered tight. With the exception of the open back door, they appear to take security seriously around here. Belatedly, I realize I should have looked for cameras, outside as well as in. I wonder if I'm being recorded as I continue my path down the central corridor, still searching for signs of life. Next up, a smaller gym with mats on the floor and a boxing ring in the middle. It makes me think of Detective Lotham, and I wonder if he ever came here to help out. Certainly, Officer O'Shaughnessy must know this place well, being the community liaison. Voices. Finally. I follow the sounds to the end of the corridor, where light floods out from two separate offices. I poke my head into the doorway on the right first, encountering two African-American men, one short, one tall. Hi, I say. They stare at me. Are you in charge here? They stare at me. I consult my notes from my new Dunkin' Donuts friends. Is one of you Dutch, or maybe Antoine?
Dutch,
the shorter one concedes. He wears a whistle around his neck. I didn't know that kind of thing was done anymore. Excellent. Charity recommended that I talk to you about the rec center programs. I just moved into the area and would like to learn more. I deliver my best, I'm completely harmless smile. Then I stick out my hand. They take turns shaking it, which seems to break the ice. I understand you run an after-school program for local youths.
Yes, ma'am.
The shorter man, Dutch, confirms. His accent sounds pure Boston, no trace of immigrant anything. Please call me Frankie. And you are? I turn to the taller man, who appears roughly 40 years old and has the erect bearing of a natural leader. Frédéric Lagoudou, the man says, with a trill of sand and sea. I gravitate toward him immediately. I'm a friend of the Badeau family. I understand from Ms. Violette that her niece and nephew came here often.
You are here about Angelique Badeau?
Frédéric asks, dark eyes narrowing. Yes.
She did not go missing here. She was back in school. That is what they say.
They say? He flushes.
What I know to be true.
That's what I've heard too, I assure him. I'm curious about the summer before school started, when Angelique and her brother Emmanuel were both here. The two men exchange glances again. I understand their natural distrust. I'm not the police, which makes me an unknown variable. Ms. Violette put me in touch with Officer O'Shaughnessy. I volunteer now. He recommended I talk with you. A stretch, but effective. Both men relax. O'Shaughnessy probably did help out around here, as I'd suspected. And while it might be a white lie, even if the men called O'Shaughnessy directly to check me out, I doubt he'd throw me under the bus. I've stirred up more activity in Angelique's case in the past 2 days than the BPD did in the past 2 months.
I know Angelique and her brother,
Frédéric confirms now.
Please, come to my office. We can talk there.
I think that's a marvelous offer. I follow him across the hall to a small, straightforward setup. Desk, ancient computer, coat rack, half-dead office plant. Frédéric has a brightly framed poster of a coat of arms on the wall, a palm tree upright in the middle of two golden cannons and what appears to be bayonets, cannonballs, anchors, bugles, all in patriotic colors of green, blue, and red. Below it reads, L'Union fait la force,
our national emblem,
Frédéric tells me, following my gaze,
from Haiti, the country of my heart.
When did you immigrate?
20 years ago.
Meaning he wasn't caught up in the current visa turmoil of the earthquake survivors. Do you still have family back on the island?
1 brother, 2 sisters.
They don't want to come here?
Maybe their children, for school. It's better here than there.
I understand Angelique and her brother are good students, and Angelique is looking forward to studying medicine at a U.S. college. Frédéric shrugs.
I'm the executive director. We serve over 500 families through our various programs. I know all a little, but none very well.
How does summer camp work? Do the kids sign up for specialized activities? Something? Frédéric lays it out for me. Youths register for specific programs based on age and interest. After consulting his computer, he can tell me Angelique signed up for fashion camp while Emmanuel pursued basketball. I'm not sure why future Dr. Angelique would choose fashion till Frédéric produces the program description. Apparently, fashion camp involves lots of sketching and art. Remembering the highly detailed medical drawings I'd found in the teens' collection, that makes sense. The activity director is a woman named Lillian, who is an art teacher from a local middle school and works for the rec center during the summer. Frédéric doesn't want to give me her contact information, but promises he'll pass along my phone number to her. He pulls up the program registration, showing 18 kids, 16 girls, 2 boys. Sure enough, Marjolie's name is right after Angelique's. Most likely they signed up together. The way friends do. Do you remember Angelique hanging out with anyone in particular? I ask now, not giving away Marjolie's name. Frédéric pauses, leaning back his long frame and steepling elegant fingers together as he considers the matter.
There was 1 girl. They sat together, also Haitian, shorter, pretty, They seemed to know each other well. But this other girl didn't care about fashion class so much. She spent more of her time in the gym.
Like playing basketball or something?
Like watching the boys playing basketball.
He arches a suggestive brow. Boyfriend or boy crazy?
One boy in particular. I once had to interrupt a social situation that had gone too far.
I take that to mean Marjorie had been making out with said love interest in some random corner. Frankly, if I'd been at summer camp in this vast building at that age, had to be secluded spots everywhere, and I bet the kids knew every single one. What about Angelique? Ever interrupt one of her social situations?
Frederick shakes his head.
Did she have a tendency to drift out of her program to, say, watch basketball, boxing, baseball, whatever? I'm pursuing the theory that Angelique had a secret romance, especially with her best friend distracted by some basketball player. Maybe Angelique had felt compelled to do likewise.
She would go on occasion to watch her brother,
Frederick supplies.
During breaks, though, she never missed class, at least not that I ever heard, and it is my job to hear such things.
His picture of Angelique is consistent with everything else I've been told about the teen. For now, I table the boyfriend idea and return to my own thought from the night before. What about another girl? A new friend Angelique bonded with while Marjorie was off drooling in the gym? Frederick frowns, hesitates.
This was 2 summers ago.
And yet Angelique went missing shortly thereafter. Don't tell me you haven't thought about it. He winces. I can't even imagine how hard his job must be, trying to both corral and inspire hundreds of at-risk teens, wanting to make a difference, knowing there are limits. And then when one of the kids, who by all accounts should make it, simply vanishes one fall afternoon, I have a feeling Frederick has done nothing but replay the memories he has of Angelique over and over again.
I wish I had noticed more,
he concedes now.
Paid more attention, made more effort. But Angelique, she was a good kid. She came on time. She stayed with her program. She produced many beautiful drawings. Lillian posted several around the halls. I remember congratulating Angelique on her work. She seemed shy, but again, not one to get into trouble. My time, my job, is spent more with those teens.
He shrugs.
It is regretful, but it is what it is.
You have problems with gang activity here? I change gears.
We are zero tolerance. Any gang signs, colors, activity leads to immediate expulsion.
The kids know.
Off the grounds, yes, there are problems. But when they enter this property, if they want to shoot hoops, they play nice. It works more effectively than you think.
Are there times all the kids intermix? I mean, regardless of fashion camp versus boxing camp or whatnot?
Lunch is within each group. It makes it easier for us to monitor. But there are breaks during the day. Kids wander. Some might go watch a part of a soccer game or gather to enjoy the sun outside. They are teens, and we want the programs to be fun, not just...
He struggles for the word. Glorified lockup? I volunteer. He sighs but doesn't disagree. Can I get a copy of this list? I point to the registration list for fashion camp.
The police have it.
I don't want to bother them. I'm trying to find new leads to move us forward, not make them go backward. He hesitates again, but my argument is a decent one. He prints me out a fresh list. One last thing, if you don't mind. A simple memory exercise. You know Angelique's face? He nods. Now, picture her. Here, the last time you saw her. Where is she? It takes him a moment, but he complies, even going so far as to close his eyes.
Angelique is sitting outside on a yellow bench. She has her sketchpad on her lap, her head bent over as she draws. As I walk by, making my rounds. She doesn't look up, but continues to sketch. Very fast, very focused. I can hear the scratch of charcoal against the page. I remember thinking she looked like a true artist, with a vision in her head she must capture immediately, before it disappeared forever. I was impressed.
Could you see the drawing?
No, but she was wearing her hair down. She had thick ringlets that hung in front of her like a curtain.
Were there other kids around her?
Silence as he digs deeper into his recollection. I see three boys. They have a hacky sack and are kicking it around. Two more girls sitting on another bench. One is giggling. There are other kids lounging in the grass. The weather is very beautiful.
Who is closer to Angelique? A boy? A girl?
I see only the three boys, and they are busy with their game.
Anyone else? Someone near Angelique, or maybe, like you, noticing Angelique, even if she doesn't notice them?
Slowly, he says, there's another girl, seated on the ground further down, her back against the building. She is also drawing, but she is in the shade, not the sun. She is looking in Angelique's direction. She is watching Angelique draw. When I walk by, however, the girl ducks her head quickly. Too quickly, I think. I'm about to stop, push a little. Then I hear yelling in the soccer field. I turn and head there.
What does this other girl look like?
Another teen. I remember seeing her in the fashion camp as well.
Frederick opens his eyes, shakes his head.
But I don't remember her face. I'm not even sure I ever saw it fully. I could always find her in a crowd, however, by looking for her hat.
Every day, regardless of weather or conditions, she wore the same red ball cap. And yes, now that you mention it, she was often staring at Angelique.
Chapter 16. I've barely left the rec center property, heading back down the main boulevard with a vague notion of finding my bus stop, when a white car goes roaring past me in the opposite lane. It slams on its brakes, performs a hard U-turn, and zips up beside me.
Get in,
Detective Lotham orders. I stare at him for a moment, not trying to be belligerent, but definitely disoriented.
I know you like to walk, he growls.
Actually, I was headed for the bus.
Stop being so damn contrarian and get the hell in.
The moment he calls me contrarian, I naturally want to protest. But the urgency in his voice, underlaid with anger, and maybe even a hint of fear, catches my attention. I get in. I've no sooner shut the door than he floors the gas. The sudden acceleration slams me back against my seat, and I scramble for a seatbelt.
What do you know about counterfeiting?
He asks me, both hands on the wheel, eyes fixed forward. He's leaning forward, as if throwing his whole body into his aggressive driving.
As in money? U.S. currency, to be exact.
I thought that was very hard to do.
Exactly. Meaning it's not a small-time DIY enterprise. The good fakes generally come from overseas, Europe, Russia. You need the right equipment and a master tradesperson to pull it off. Computers have simplified the process some. The good forgers scan hundreds of images of, say, a Ben Franklin, then create a 3D master plate based off the composite image, provides the bills with the same printing imperfections the U.S. Treasury installed on purpose. Still, there are watermarks and special paper and reflective dyes. Not something for the average criminal to execute.
I nod, then start to connect the dots. Why Detective Lotham is suddenly an expert on forgery.
The bills from Angelique's lamp,
I murmur out loud. Of all the findings from the hidden cache, this is not one I'd expected.
A tenth of them are counterfeit. Almost exactly. Which, according to the Secret Service agent who showed up in my office this morning, is how it's usually done.
They mix in fake money with real money so it's less noticeable? We come to a red light. Lotham hits a switch on his dash, issuing a shrill whoop whoop, and we scream on through. I grab hold of the oh shit handle, still not knowing where we are going with such urgency. Angelique's stash isn't as large as it appears. We're talking rolls of 20s wrapped in hundreds. Okay, it's a popular trick among the streetwise to appear richer than they are. Give me a total. Stashed in that lamp was about $12,000. Still an impressive haul. Yep, but the outer layer, the Ben Franklins, those were counterfeit? Exactly. To make matters more interesting, these particular counterfeits have been in circulation for years, apparently. They're called the Russian notes because the U.S. Secret Service believes they were first printed there. Using an offset printer, probably in a giant warehouse with specialized dyes, acids. Again, not a local job. I nod, though more to register I've heard the words than I understand them. We hit another intersection, and with a fresh whoop whoop, we slice through two lanes of traffic before instigating a hard left across oncoming traffic. My stomach tightens. A fresh boost of speed, then we clear imminent death and sail down a narrow side street. Are the counterfeiters actually chasing us? I ask Detective Lotham. Or is this your competitive streak now that a federal agency is involved? Forget Secret Service. They already have the bills, and based on the serial numbers, they already know the source. For them, this is mop-up from a decades-old operation. Some Russian syndicate executed tens of millions of near-perfect fakes. They sold them for 10 cents on the dollar to a distributor, who sold them for 25 cents on the dollar to various middlemen in various countries, who finished the food chain by selling them locally for 60 cents on the dollar. According to Agent Ford, they'll be recovering the fake Benjamins for the rest of his life and from all over the world. So, how did Angelique end up with them? That remains our problem. How? Who? Why? According to Agent Ford, any one of us might be carrying a counterfeit without knowing it. But a dozen of them, each wrapped around a bundle of real $20 bills? That's not random. We certainly have Russian gangs in Boston, which might explain how we ended up with these fakes in this area, but not too many Russian crime bosses are hanging out with Mattapan gangbangers. Criminal enterprises are notoriously snobbish, and our local gangs aren't sophisticated enough for Russian interest. I have no idea what to say to this. It's okay. In the way Boston works, a random street has appeared ahead, forking a right diagonal, not to be confused with the three other diagonals flaring out around it. Lotham hits that turn as hard as he hits the others. Apparently, he's in a temper this morning. Did you sleep last night? I ask him.
Does at a desk count? Minute I logged those bills into evidence, my phone started ringing off the hook. And then my sergeant called me into his office.
So it's your sergeant we're running away from?
Don't be a wise ass.
I'm more worried about becoming a soon-to-be-dead dumbass. Why the bells and whistles?
We have a sighting.
What?
A teen matching Angelique's description just tried to purchase a fresh burner phone using a fake ID. The ID bears the same name, Tamara Levesque, as the one given to the Cyber Cafe clerk 2 weeks ago. Officer O'Shaughnessy is already there, fanning out with a few other units, hoping to get lucky.
We're joining the hunt? I don't know which surprises me more, that there's an active search after all these months, or that I've been invited to participate.
We are not doing anything. I'm interviewing the sales specialists. You?
Lotham blew out a hard breath.
Heaven help me, he muttered.
I'm there for moral support?
No, you're there because one of the witnesses, some guy named Charlie, asked for you.
By the time we come to a screeching halt, the scene in front of the wireless company is a pile of blue-uniformed officers, a crowd of gawkers, and, if I'm not mistaken, a number of corner dealers backpedaling furiously down the street. Detective Lotham spares the retreating youths a look, but doesn't acknowledge or pursue. Today is their lucky day. The police have bigger fish to fry. I spot Charlie almost immediately, He stands outside the storefront, his large size and authentic army jacket making a statement. Next to him stands a female beat cop, clearly waiting. Detective Lotham ushers me through the crowd. Once on the other side of the madness, he pauses long enough to state, "When you're done talking to your friend, remember who drove you here." Then he disappears into the store, leaving me to cross the remaining space to Charlie. I feel suddenly awkward, unsure of what to say. We've met only once at an AA meeting. In the midst of this hoopla, why ask for me? Charlie doesn't speak right away, but nods his greeting. Then he stares at the female officer. She gives me a look as if to say he's on my problem now. She drifts off 5 feet, still monitoring, but allowing some privacy. "Detective Lotham said you asked for me." Charlie stares at me. He has his hands in his coat pockets. It makes him look bigger, broader. I don't think he's trying to appear intimidating as much as he simply can't help it. But I still don't find him threatening. The man joined the service because he has an instinct to protect. And some things, no matter the trauma,